me, opening a corridor perhaps half an inch wider than my shoulders and the same distance higher than my head. I walked out slowly, dreamily, feeling deliciously detached from everything. I had to step over a hand on the way out. It twitched in flickering little autonomic spasms. I noted idly that it probably should have bothered me more than it did. Outside, I found Carlos and the Mixani children. They were staring at me in silence. The sleet made the only sound. Few lights glowed in windows. Unalaska was battened down against the storm, and other than us, not a creature was stirring. I closed my eyes, lifted my face to the storm, and murmured, "Burn it down." Carlos stepped past me without a word. I felt the stirrings of power as he focused his will into fire so hot that the air hissed and sizzled and spat as he brought it forth. A moment later, warmth glowed behind me, and the crackle and mutter of rising flames began. As we walked away, one wall was already covered in a 5-foot curtain of flame. By the time we got the children back to the fish market, the cathedral was a beacon that spread an eerie glow through the sleet and spray. A few lights had come on, and I could see dark figures and a couple of emergency vehicles near the pyre, but there would be no saving the place. It was set a bit apart from the rest of Unalaska in any case. It would burn alone. Cormorants had begun to circle us, their cries awed and muted in the dark, and the children looked up with uncertain smiles. When we reached the market and went in, Aluki and Nauja were waiting for us. Nauja let out a cry and rushed forward to embrace the smallest girl, a child who cried out, "Mama!" and threw her arms around the Mixani woman's neck. Cormorants winged in from out of the night through the open door, assuming human form with effortless grace as they landed. Glad voices were raised around the children, and more parents were reunited with their lost little ones. There were more hugs and laughter and happy tears. That, I thought, should probably make me feel more than it does as well. Carlos watched it with a big, warm grin on his face. He shook some hands and nodded pleasantly and was hugged and clapped on the shoulder. As I watched him, I felt something finally. I was admiring his scars, the memory of his skill, his courage, and I had an absolutely soul-deep need to run my fingers over him. No one came within 5 feet of me, at least not until Aluki crossed the room from the bier where her husband still lay, facing me.
"I assume you wish the tribute now," she said in a low voice.
I felt dark, bright eyes all over the room, focusing on me.
"I need rest and food," I said. "I will return when the storm breaks, if that is acceptable."
Aluki blinked, and her head rocked back.
Yes, of course, Lady Molly. Thank you for that."
I gave her a nod and turned toward the door. Just before leaving, I looked over my shoulder and asked, "Carlos, are you coming with?"
"Ah," he said, and his smile changed several shades. Why, yes, I am."
By the time we reached Carlos's hotel, the storm was raging, and the weather had gotten worse too. Neither of us spoke as we reached his room, and he opened the door for me. It was a nice hotel, far nicer than I would have expected in such isolation. I walked in, dropping my coat to the floor behind me. It hit the ground with the squelching sound of wet cloth and crackles of thin ice breaking. Layers of shirts joined it as I kept walking into the room until I was down to skin. I felt his eyes on me the whole way. Then I turned slowly and smiled at him. His expression was caught somewhere between awe and hunger. His dark eyes glittered brightly.
"You're soaked and frozen," I said quietly. "Get out of those clothes."
He nodded slowly and walked toward me. His cloak and coat and shirts joined mine. Carlos Ramirez had the muscles of a gymnast, and his body was marked here and there with scars. Strength. Prowess.
I approved. He stopped in front of me, down to his own jeans. Then he kept walking toward me until our bodies met and he pressed me gently down to the bed behind us. My eyes closed as I let out a little groan when I felt the heat of his skin against my chest, and I flung myself into the kiss that came next like the world was about to vanish into a nuclear apocalypse. The sudden explosion of desire that radiated out from him felt like sinking into a steaming hot bath, and I reveled in it, my own ardor rising. My hands slid over his chest and shoulders, reached around to his back. He was all tight muscle, heat, and pure passion. His mouth wandered to my throat, then to my shoulders and breasts, and I let out groans of need, encouraging him. "Molly," said the voice of my better reason. His mouth left me for a second as he pulled off my boots. I arched up to help him remove my jeans and heard him kicking off his own. With an impatient growl, I sat up and ripped at his belt. "Molly," said reason again. "Hello?" I flung the belt across the room to tell reason to shut up and tore at his jeans. I had never wanted anything so badly in my life as I wanted Carlos naked and pressed against me. "This isn't you," said Reason. I pushed his jeans down past his hips. God, he was beautiful. I took his hand and leaned back on the bed, drawing him with me. "Now," I said. My voice came out thick and husky. "No more waiting. Now." He let out a groan as he kissed me again, and I felt him start to touch, and then... And then I was sitting on the floor of the shower, shuddering, hot water pouring down around me. Wait, what? What the hell? I looked down at the water. The drain stopper was down, and it was 7 or 8 inches deep. And pink. Oh, God. I looked at my hands. My nails. My nails looked longer, harder. And there was red under them. What had just happened? I stood up and left the shower, dripping wet, not bothering to stop for a towel. I hurried back out of the bathroom and stopped in the doorway, shocked. The room had been wrecked. The mattress was against the far wall, and the door. It had been torn in half. The lamps were out, and the slice of light from the bathroom lights provided the only illumination in a stark column. What I could see of the furniture had been trashed. Part of the bed frame was broken. And Carlos? He lay on the floor, covered in blood. One of his legs was broken, the pointy bits of his shattered shin thrusting out from the skin. His face was swelling up beneath the blood, his eyes puffed closed. He was covered in claw marks, rakes that oozed blood. He lay at a strange angle, twitching in pain, one hand clutching with blind instinct at his back. His injured back. His weakness. I stared down at my hands in utter horror, at the blood beneath my nails. I had done this. I had used his weakness against him. "Mab," I breathed. I started choking and sobbing. "Mab! Mab!" Mab can appear in a thunderclap if she wants to. This entrance was much less dramatic. A light in the far corner of the room clicked on and revealed the Queen of Winter, seated calmly in the chair in the corner. She regarded me with distant, opalescent eyes and lifted a single eyebrow. "What happened?" I asked. "What happened?" Mab regarded Carlos with a calm countenance.
"What will happen every time you attempt to be with a man?" she replied.
I stared at her.
"What?"
"Three queens of summer, three queens of winter," she said, that alien gaze returning to me. "Maiden, mother, and crone. You are the maiden, Lady Molly, and for you to be otherwise, to become a mother, would be to destroy the mantle of power you wear. The mantle protected itself, as it must."
"What?" She tilted her head and stared at me.
"It is all within the law. I suggest you spend a few hours each day meditating on it in the future. In time, you will gain an adequate understanding of your limits.
How could you do this? I demanded. The tears on my cheeks felt like streaks of hot wax. How could you do this?
I did not, Mab said calmly. You did.
Damn it, you know what I mean.
You have been gifted with great and terrible power, young lady, Mab said in an arch tone. Did you really think you could simply go about your life as if you were a mortal girl?
You could have warned me.
When I tried, you had no inclination to listen, only to jest.
You bitch, I said, shaking my head. You could have told me. You horrible bitch.
I turned to go back into the bathroom to get towels and go to Carlos's aid. When I turned, Mab was right behind me, and her nose all but pressed against mine. Her eyes were flickering through shades of color and bright with cold anger. Her voice came out in a velvet murmur more terrifying than any enraged shriek.
What did you say to me?
I flinched back, suddenly filled with fear. I couldn't meet her eyes. I didn't speak. After a moment, some of the tension went out of her.
Yes, she said, her voice calm again. I could have told you. I elected to teach you. I trust this has made a significant first impression.
I have to help him, I said. Please step aside.
That will not be necessary, Mab said. He will not be in danger of dying for some hours. I have already dispatched word to the White Council. Their healers will arrive momentarily to care for him. You will leave at once.
I can't just leave him like this, I said.
That is exactly what you can do, Mab said,
her voice softened by a tiny fraction of a degree.
You are no longer what you were, child. You must adapt to your new world. If you do not, you will cause terrible suffering, not least of all to yourself.
She tilted her head as if listening and said,
The storm is breaking. You have your duty.
I clenched my jaw and said, I can't just leave him there alone. Mab blinked once, as if digesting my words.
Why not?
Because it's not what decent people do.
What has that to do with either of us?
She asked. I shook my head.
No, I am not going to be like that.
Mab pursed her lips and exhaled slowly through her nose.
Stubborn, like our knight.
Damned right I am, I said.
I'm not sure you can micro-roll your eyes, but Mab can.
Very well. I will sit with him until the wizards arrive.
I turned to regard Carlos's broken form lying on the floor. Then I hurried into enough clothes to be decent. I knelt over him and kissed his forehead. He made a soft moaning sound that tore something inside my chest.
I'm sorry,
I whispered. I kissed his head again.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know what would happen. I'm sorry.
Time waits for no one, Lady Molly, Mab said.
She had crossed the room to stand across from me over poor Carlos.
Not even the Queens of Faerie. Collect the tribute.
I gave him a last kiss on the forehead and rose to leave, but I paused at the door to consult Winter Law. I had never really considered what the tribute was, but it was there in the law. I turned slowly and stared at Mab in horror.
They're children, I whispered. You want me to take their children?
Yes.
They're children, I said. You can't.
I won't. You will.
I shook my head.
But, Lady Molly, Mab said gently, consider the outer gates.
I did. Winter Law showed me a vivid image. An endless war fought at the far borders of reality, a war against the pitiless alien menace known simply as the Outsiders, a war fought by millions of Fae to prevent the outsiders from invading and destroying reality itself. A war so long and bitter that bones of the fallen were the topography of the landscape. It was why the Winter Court existed in the first place, why we were so aggressive, so savage, so filled with lust and the need to create more of our kind.
You're filling me with a hunger I can never feed, I whispered.
We cannot expect our people to bear a burden that we do not, Mab replied, her tone level, implacable. You will learn to endure it.
You want me to take children, I hissed.
I am fighting a war, Mab said simply. Fighting a war requires soldiers.
But they're children. Children like my little brothers and sisters, and you want me to carry them away?
Of course. It is the ideal time to learn, to be trained until they come into their strength and are ready to do battle, Mab said. It is the only way to prepare them for what is to come, the only way to give them a chance to survive the duties I require of them.
How long? I asked through clenched teeth. How long will they be gone?
Until they are no longer needed, Mab said.
Until they're killed, you mean, I said.
They're never going back home.
Your outrage is irrelevant, Mab said.
Her voice was flat, calm, filled with undeniable logic.
I have condemned millions of the children of Winter to a life of violence and death in battle because it must be done. If we fail in our duty, there will be no home to which they can return. There will be no mortal world, safe and whole for your brothers and sisters.
But
my protest trailed off weakly.
If you have an alternative, I would be more than willing to consider it.
Silence stretched.
I don't, I said quietly.
Then do your duty, Mab said.
I opened the door and looked back at her. I don't yet, I said, and I said it hard. This isn't over. Mab gave me the slow blink again. Then she inclined her head by a fraction of an inch, her expression pensive. I turned and left the broken form of Carlos Ramirez behind me to steal away the Mixani's children. And I couldn't stop crying.
Jury duty. When you set out to write a wizard, there are a lot of issues you have to face. How does the magic work? Where did he get his power? What is the nature of magic in relation to the universe? How do people regard magic in that story world? And on and on and on. Those are pretty obvious questions. They make for some really fun and occasionally thought-provoking tales. But as story devices, wizards also have some inherent problems with their popular perception. They are generally loner figures living in some tower and only occasionally interacting with the world, which works great when the wizard is a supporting figure and is complete garbage when it comes to having a wizard as a central character. Wizards have tremendous power, which is great when it's coming from a supporting character who has limitations that mean he can only occasionally do something. But, again, when casting the wizard as the central character, from a storytelling standpoint, all that power is a liability, not an asset. Protagonists have to be challenged, struggle, and grow, not just mow down everything that gets in their way with their Tensor's Mystic Inflammable Bulldozer spell. So, I knew I was going to have to subvert some of these popular perceptions from the very get-go. To do that, I turn to a different set of archetypes, magicians. Short version, there are three archetypes of performing magicians. The dark and mysterious guy, the glitzy professional showman guy, and the apparently incompetent buffoon. The popular perception of wizards definitely fits in that first category. But it ain't a simple trick to write dark and mysterious in a first-person protagonist. By its very nature, first-person viewpoint is incredibly intimate, and hiding things from the audience while using that viewpoint works against its deepest strength. So dark and mysterious was out. Glitzy was out too, because I'm not sure Burt Wonderstone could carry a series. So basically I went with option three, the buffoon. And the way I chose to do it was to make my protagonist a young, clumsy puppy of a wizard who was absolutely incompetent at real life, in this case reflected in how his magical powers disrupt modern technology. Once I knew I was doing that, it seemed clear that I had to go all in. While I needed him to be pretty savvy about matters pertaining to the wild side of life so that he could be good at his job, I wanted to make him into a character who was constantly challenged by the most mundane issues. Paying his bills, fixing his car, dealing with his landlord, struggling with taxes and the DMV, and all the dumb stuff we grown-ups have to do, which, in our honest moments, we admit that we just hate doing and would much rather have some milk and a cookie and a nap. This tale, set after the events of Skin Game, chronicles the latest clash between the mighty wizard Dresden and the dread forces of the real world. In this case, a summons to jury duty.
"I don't believe it. They found me," I muttered grimly. I looked left and right, checking around me for lurking threats. "I don't know how, but they did it. I've been back in the world for less than a month and they found me." Will Borden, engineer and werewolf, set down a heavy box of books on the kitchen table and looked at me with concern. Then he came over and looked down at the letter in my hands before snorting. "Such a drama queen." "I'm serious," I said and shook the letter. "I'm being hunted by my own government." "It's a summons to jury duty, Harry," Will said. He opened the fridge and helped himself to a bottle of Max Ale. He had to navigate around a few boxes to do it. I didn't think I'd had much out on the island, but it's amazing how many boxes it takes to hold not much. It had taken most of the day to ferry it all from the island into Molly's apartment in town. She rarely used the place these days and had given it to me to live in until I found my own digs. "I don't like it," I said. "Too bad," Will said. "You got it. Look, you probably won't be selected anyway." "Summons," I said, glowering. "It's a freaking command. If they want to see what a real summoning is, I could show them." Will laughed at me. He was younger than me, shorter than average, and built like a linebacker. "How dare they intrude upon the solitude of the mighty wizard Dresden?" "Yeah," I said, and tossed the paper onto the top of a box of unopened envelopes. My mail, which had accumulated for more than a year, most of it junk. Some of it had been at the post office. More had been set aside by the new owner of my old address, formerly Mrs. Spunklecreef's boarding house, and now the Better Future Society. I hadn't been able to stomach asking the new owner for my mail, but Butters had gotten it for me. "Maybe I won't show up," I said. I paused. "What happens if I don't show up?" "You can be held in contempt of court or fined or jailed or something," Will said. He scratched his chin thoughtfully. "Now that I think about it, they actually leave it kind of vague what's going to happen." "Good threats are like that. Scarier when you can use your imagination." "The government isn't the mob, Harry." "Aren't they?" I asked. "Pay them money every year to protect you, and God help you if you don't." Will rolled his eyes and got another bottle from the fridge. He opened it for me and passed it over. "Mac would kill you for drinking this cold, etc. and so on." "It's hot out," I said and took a long pull, "especially for this early in the year. Andy would just give me that disappointed grunting sound. Damn government. Not like I don't have things to do." "Is justice worth having?" Will asked. I eyed him. "Is it?" "Mostly," I said warily. "Well, that's why there's a legal system." "What does justice have to do with the legal system?" "Do you really want to tear it all apart and start over from 1776? Will asked. "Not particularly. I have books to read." He spread his hands. "The courts aren't perfect," Will said, "but they can do okay a lot of the time." He reached into the box and picked up the summons. "And if you really think the courts aren't working, maybe you should do something about it. If only there was some way you could directly participate." I snatched the letter back from him with a scowl. "Think you're smart, huh?" "You're kind of a solitary hunter by nature, Harry," Will said. I'm more of a pack creature. We're smart about different things, that's all. I read a little more. There's a dress code, too, I demanded. Will covered up his mouth with his hand and coughed, but I could see that he was laughing at me. Well, I said firmly, I'm not wearing a tie. Will lowered his hand, his expression carefully locked into sober agreement. Viva la revolution. So, I went to court. It meant a trek downtown to the Richard J. Daley Center Courthouse, whose name did little to inspire confidence in me that justice might indeed be done. Ah, well, I wasn't here to create disorder. I was here to preserve disorder. I went up to the 17th floor, turned in my card, along with about a gazillion other people, none of whom seemed all that enthusiastic about being there. Got a cup of bad coffee and grimaced at it while waiting around for a while. Then a guy in a black muumuu showed up and recounted the plot of My Cousin Vinny. Okay, it was a robe, and the guy was a judge, and he gave us a brief outline of the format of the trial system. But it's not nearly as entertaining to say it that way. And they started calling names. They said they only needed about half of us. And when they had been going for a while, I thought I was about to get lucky and get sent home. But then some clerk called my name, and I had to shuffle forward and join a file of other jurors. There were lines and questions and a lot of waiting around. Long story short, I wound up sitting in the box seats in a Cook County courtroom as the wheels of justice started to grind for a guy named Hamilton Luther. The case was being handled by one of the new ADAs. I used to keep track of those people pretty closely, but then I was mostly dead for a while, and then living in exile, and my priorities shifted. When you live in a city with a reputation for political corruption as pervasive as Chicago's, and work in a business that sometimes treads close to the limit of the law, or 20 miles past it, it's wise to keep an eye on the public servants. Most of them were decent enough, I guess, by which I mean they were your basic politicians. They had just enough integrity to keep up appearances and appease political sponsors, and at the end of the day, they had an agenda to pursue. Once in a while, though, you got one who was thoroughly in someone's pocket. The outfit owned some of those types. The unions owned some others. The corporations had the rest. The new kid was in his late 20s, clean-cut, thoroughly shaven, and looked a little distracted as he assembled notes and folders around him with the help of an attractive female assistant. His gray suit was tailored to him, maybe a little too well tailored for someone just out of law school, and his maroon tie was made of expensive silk that matched the kerchief tucked into his breast pocket. He had big ears and a large Adam's apple, and his expression was painfully earnest. On the other side of the aisle, at the defendant's table, sat a study in contrast. He was a man in his 50s, and if he'd ever been in college, it had been on a wrestling scholarship. He had shoulders like a bull moose, hunched with muscle, and his arms ended in fists the size of sledgehammer heads. The dark skin on his knuckles was white and lumpy with old scars, the kind you get in back-alley fist fights, not in a boxing ring. He had shaved his head. There was stubble around the edges, but the top was shiny. He had a heavy brow, a nose that had been broken on a biannual basis, and his suit was cheap and ill-fitting. He had a couple of folders on the table with him, along with a pair of thick books. The man looked bleakly uneasy and kept flicking nervous glances across the aisle. If that guy was a lawyer, I was an Ewok. But he sat alone. So where was his public defender? All rise, a large man in a uniform said in a voice pitched to Carrie. Court is now in session. The Honorable Mavis Jefferson presiding. Everyone stood up. After a second, so did I. Guess you could say I'm not really a joiner. The judge came in and settled down at her bench, and the rest of us sat too. She was a blocky woman in her early 60s, with skin the color of coffee grounds and bags under her eyes that made me think of Spike the Bulldog in those old cartoons. If you didn't look closely, you'd think she was bored out of her mind. She sat without moving much, her eyes half closed, scanning over a document on her desk through a pair of reading glasses. There was something serpentine about her eyes, a suggestion of formidable, remorseless rationality. This was a woman who had seen a great deal, had been amused by very little of it, and who would not be easily made a fool. She finished scanning the document and glanced up at the defendant. "Mr. Luther," she said. The bruiser in the bad suit rose.
"Yes, ma'am."
"I see that you have taken it upon yourself to serve as your own defender," she said. Her tone was bored, entirely neutral. "While this is your right under the law, I strongly advise you to reconsider. Given the severity of the charges against you, I would think that a professional attorney would offer you a much more comprehensive and capable legal defense."
"Yes, ma'am," Luther said. "I thought that, too. But all the public defender wanted to do was plea bargain, ma'am, and I want to have my say."
"That, too, is your right," the judge said. For a second I thought I saw a flicker of something like regret on her face, but it vanished into neutrality again almost instantly. Her tone took on the measured cadence of a cop reading formal Miranda rights. "If you go through with this, you will not be able to move for a mistrial based on the fact that you do not have adequate representation. This trial will proceed, and its outcome will be binding. Do you understand this warning as I have stated it to you?"
"Yes, ma'am," Luther said. "Ain't no take-backsies. I want to represent myself, ma'am."
The judge nodded. "Then you may be seated." Luther sat. The judge turned toward the prosecutor and nodded to him. "Counselor."
There was a pause about a second and a half long,
and then she repeated in a mildly annoyed tone, "Counselor." Another impatient pause. "Counselor Tremont, am I interrupting you?" The young ADA in the fine suit blinked, looked up from his notes, and hastily rose. "No, Your Honor, please excuse me. I'm ready to begin." "Thank goodness," the judge said in a dry tone. "My granddaughter graduates from high school in 3 weeks. You may proceed." Tremont flushed. Yes, thank you, Your Honor." The young man cleared his throat, adjusted his suit tie, and walked over to face the jury box. He held up a glossy, professional headshot of a handsome man in his 30s and showed it to us. "Meet Curtis Black," Tremont said. "He was a stockbroker. He liked to go rock climbing on the weekends. He volunteered in a soup kitchen 3 weekends a month, and he once won an all-expenses-paid vacation to Florida by making a half-court shot during halftime at a Bulls game. He was well-liked by his professional associates and had an extensive family, and was owned by an Abyssinian cat named Purple. You have doubtless noted my use of the past tense. Was, liked, volunteered. But I have to use the past tense, because 1 year ago, Curtis Black was brutally murdered in an alley in Wrigleyville near the corner of Southport and Grace. Mr. Black was bludgeoned to death with a bowling pin. His skull was smashed flat in the back, and the autopsy showed that it had been shattered into a dozen pieces, like plate glass. Tremont took a moment to let the graphic description set in. The room was very still.
"The state intends to prove," he said, "that the defendant, Hamilton Luther, murdered Mr. Black in cold blood, that he followed him into the alley, seized the bowling pin from a refuse bin, and struck him from behind, causing him to fall to the ground, that he then proceeded to continue beating Mr. Black's skull with 12 to 15 heavy blows while Mr. Black lay stunned and helpless beneath him." "This is a serious crime," Tremont continued. "But Mr. Luther has a long history of violent offenses. Forensic evidence will prove that Mr. Luther was at the crime scene, that he left his fingerprints on the weapon, and that the forensic profile of the attack matches his height and build closely. Eyewitnesses and security cameras witnessed him fleeing the alley shortly after Mr. Black entered it, the victim's blood literally on his hands. The evidence will prove Mr. Luther's guilt beyond any reasonable doubt, and in the end, you must find him guilty of this horrible crime. Thank you." "Thank you, Counselor," the judge said, as Tremont returned to his seat. "Mr. Luther, you may present your opening statement."
Luther rose slowly. He glanced around the jury box, licked his lip nervously, and approached the jury.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said, stammering a little, "I know I got it passed. I did a dime in Stateville for putting a guy in the hospital. But that was my past. I ain't that man no more."
He swallowed and gestured vaguely over his shoulder toward Tremont.
"This guy is going to tell you about all this CSI stuff that says I did it. But all those reports and pictures don't tell the whole story. They leave a lot of stuff out. I ain't a lawyer, but I'm going to tell you the whole story. And then I'll see what you think about it, I guess."
He hovered for a moment longer, awkwardly, then nodded and said,
"Okay, I'm done."
"Thank you, Mr. Luther," the judge said. "You may return to your seat."
"Yes, ma'am," Luther said and did so.
"Mr. Luther, you are charged with first-degree murder," the judge said, still in her rote memory voice. "How do you plead?"
Luther looked down at some notes in front of him and then up again.
"Not guilty, ma'am."
Hell's bells.
The full legal might of the state of Illinois was being thrown at Luther. The man seemed sincere enough, but apparently the only defense he had to offer was a story. A story from an ex-con, no less. I wanted to hear him out. I knew all about being judged for things that were out of my control, but I was pretty sure Luther was going back to jail.
"Mr. Tremont," the judge said, "is the prosecution ready to begin?"
"Yes, Your Honor," Tremont said.
"Very well," she said. "You may call your first witness."
Tremont spent the afternoon driving nails into Luther's coffin, thoroughly, methodically, and one at a time. He did exactly what he said he would do. He brought out each case of physical evidence, point by point, and linked Luther undeniably to the scene of the crime. Luther had been photographed by a grainy black-and-white security camera coming out of the alley's far side, spattered in blood. His fingerprints were on the murder weapon in the blood of the victim. The officer who arrested him had taken blood samples from his skin and clothing, matching those of the victim. He additionally gave testimony of Luther's past criminal record, which had landed him in jail as a young man. When given the chance to cross-examine, Luther shook his head until he got to the testimony of the arresting officer, a black man in his late 40s named Duane. He rose and asked the officer,
"When you brung me in, was I injured?"
Officer Duane nodded.
"You banged up pretty good, especially your head."
"Where at?" Luther asked.
Duane grunted, "Back of your head."
"Any other injuries on me?"
"You were one big bruise," Duane said.
"How big was the victim?" Luther asked.
"About 5'4", maybe 150.
"Weightlifter or something?"
"Not so you'd notice," Duane said.
Luther nodded. "You known me a while. How come?"
"I was the one who arrested you the first damn time."
"Officer," the judge said. "Beg pardon, Your Honor," Duane said hurriedly. "I remember that too," Luther said. "In your experience, a businessman like that handle a guy like me?"
"Unless he's armed or got a lot of training, no."
"One more question," Luther said.
He squinted at the officer and said, "You're in my neighborhood ever since I got out. You ever think I'd be trouble again?"
"Objection," Tremont said. "He's asking for pure conjecture."
Luther frowned and said, "Beat cops deal with ex-cons on a regular basis professionally, ma'am. Figure that qualifies him as an expert opinion on potential, he consulted his notes and spoke in a careful, clear tone, "recidivism."
The judge eyed Luther and said toward Tremont, "Overruled. You may answer the question, officer."
"No," Duane said. "I've seen you with your kids. I wouldn't have called you for it."
"In the arrest report," Luther said, "does it say what I kept asking the officers?"
Duane cleared his throat and looked down at a notepad in front of him.
"Yeah. The suspect kept asking, 'Where is she?' and 'Is she all right?'"
"Who was I talking about?"
Officer Duane turned a page and cleared his throat.
The suspect claimed that he only began the confrontation with the deceased after witnessing the man drag a female child, Latino, around the age of 10 into the alley, he read. Subsequent investigation could not confirm the presence of any such person.
How hard did they look? Luther asked.
I'm sorry?
You heard me, Luther said. In your opinion, how hard did the investigating detectives look for a little girl who might clear an ex-con from being guilty of a murder of a big-shot businessman?
Objection!
Overruled.
I'm not a detective, Officer Duane said. I can't speak to that, but I'm sure they follow departmental guidelines.
My finely honed crapometer, garnered during my last days as a legitimate licensed private investigator, went off. Cops were as thorough as they could be, but that wasn't always supremely thorough. That was why private investigators could stay in business in the first place. It was understandable. A city the size of Chicago has an enormous caseload. Detectives are always buried in work, and the investigations get triaged pretty severely. The preponderance of evidence, absence of witnesses, and Luther's status as an ex-con would have made this case a slam dunk, a low priority. And most of the time, the cops would have been right. Once the evidence was all taken and dissected and duly reported on, as far as the police were concerned, they had their man. And there was already a mountain of fresh justice waiting to be pursued on behalf of new victims. Even the most dedicated and sincere police detective could understandably have dropped the ball here.
Sure, Luther said. He sat back down again and said, I'm done.
The judge looked at the clock and asked, Mr. Tremont, do you have any further witnesses? Tremont listened to something his assistant whispered and rose. Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
Then so will we, she said.
Mr. Luther, the defense can begin its case in the morning. I remind the jury that the details of this case are confidential and not to be discussed or disclosed. We will reconvene here at 9 a.m.
All rise,
the bailiff said, and we did as the judge left the room. I frowned as Luther was escorted out. Something did not add up here. If Luther had been a professional tough, a little guy like Curtis Black wouldn't have a prayer against him. I've been around enough tough guys to size Luther up. I wouldn't want to take him on in a muscle-powered combat if I could avoid it. Not even now with all the extra physical stuff the Winter Knight's mantle had given me. Doesn't matter how much you bench press. Some people are damn dangerous in a fight, and you're a fool to take unnecessary chances against them. Luther struck me as one of those men. Also, Tremont was way too young a kid to be pulling a high-profile murder case like this one. This was the kind of flashy prosecution DAs love to showboat. Killers brought to justice, the system working, that kind of thing. They certainly didn't hand the case off to some kid straight out of law school. Which meant that the old hands in Chicago thought that something about this case stunk to high heaven as well. I didn't know the law really well, but I have a doctorate in the parts of Chicago that never showed up on the evening news. If Luther was telling the truth, then Curtis Black couldn't have been human. Problem was, most humans didn't know that. Even if Luther was telling the truth about Black, he wasn't going to get a fair shake from Chicago's justice system. Hell's bells, the cop acquainted with him wasn't even giving him much. Nobody was going to go to bat for him. Unless I did it. He was a father. For his kids' sake, I wanted answers. I glanced at the clock as I filed out with the rest of the jury. 9 tomorrow morning. That gave me just under 16 hours to do what wizards do best. I left and began meddling. Well, I asked the rather large wolf after he'd been casting around the alley for a while. He gave me an irritated look. He sat and after a few seconds shimmered and resumed the form of Will Borden, crouched naked on the dirty concrete.
Harry, you're not helping.
Did you find anything or not? I asked.
This isn't as easy as it looks, he said. Look, man, when I'm wolf, I've got a wolf's sense of smell, but I don't have a wolf's freaking brain.
I've been learning how to sort out signals from the noise, but it's freaking hard. I've been doing this since my freshman year, and I could follow a hot trail. But you're asking me to sift background. I don't even know if a real wolf could do it. I looked around the alley where Luther had beaten Black to death with a bowling pin. It had been nearly a year to the day since the murder. There was nothing dramatic to suggest a man had died here, and the bloodstains had long since faded into unrecognizability with the rest of the grunge. We were far enough down the alley to be out of sight of the street except for a slim column of space that cars crossed in under a second. Yeah, that was a long shot anyway. You going to wizard up some information? After this long, there's nothing left, I said. Too many rains, too many sunrises. Not even Molly could get much. Then what are we going to do? Get furry again. We might be here a while. He frowned. Why? I think the girl might come by in the next few hours. Why? I shrugged a shoulder. Let's assume Luther's telling the truth. Sure. This guy grabs a little girl and drags her into the alley. Luther jumps him from behind and gets thrown into a wall, fights him hard, and beats him to death with a bowling pin. What can we deduce? That Black was stronger than normal and tougher than normal, Will said. Some kind of supernatural. I nodded. A predator. Maybe a ghoul or something. Yeah, so? So a predator operating in the middle of a town? They don't tend to openly grab little girls off the street because someone might see it happen. Like Luther. Like Luther. But this guy did. He didn't go after a transient sleeping in an abandoned building or someone wandering down a dark alley to buy some drugs, a prostitute, any of the usual targets. He went with something dicier. He's going to do that. He's going to cut down on every random factor he can. You think he stalked her? I nodded. Stalked her, learned her pattern, and was waiting for her. Will squinted up and down the alley. Why do you think that? It's how something from Winter would do it, I said. How I would take someone in a busy part of town if I had to. Well, that's not creepy or anything, Harry. I showed my teeth. Not much difference between wolves and sheepdogs, Will. You should know. He nodded. So we wait here to see if she's still going by? Figure if she still goes by here, she'll do it fast, and she'll be worried. Should make her stand out. You know what else stands out on a busy Chicago street? A timber wolf. Thought of that, I said, and produced a roll of fabric from my duster's large pockets. You're kidding, Will said. I smiled. And what's in the guitar case? I smiled wider. A few minutes later, I was sitting on the sidewalk with my back against a building, an old second-hand guitar in my lap, the case open beside me with a handful of change and an old wadded dollar bill in it. Will settled down beside me, wearing a service dog's jacket, resting his chin on his front paws. He made a little groaning sound. It'll be fine, boy. Will narrowed his eyes. Just keep your nose open, I said, and started playing. I started with a Johnny Cash version of Hurt, which was pretty simple. I sang along with it. I'm not good, but I can hit the notes and keep the rhythm going, so it more or less worked out. I followed it up with Behind Blue Eyes, which gets a little harder, and then Only Happy When It Rains. Then I followed it up with House of the Rising Sun and completely mangled Stairway to Heaven. There wasn't a ton of foot traffic on a weekday evening on this street, not in a fairly brisk late March, but no one really looked at me twice. I made about $2.50 in change the first hour. The life of a musician is not easy. A patrol car went by, and a cop gave me the stink eye, but he didn't stop and roust me. Maybe he had things to do. The light started fading from the sky, and I was repeating my limited set for the fifth or sixth time when I started to think about giving up. The girl, if she was still following the same pattern, definitely wouldn't be running around town alone after it became fully dark. I was singing about how you get the message by the time I'm through when Will suddenly lifted his head, his eyes focused.
I followed the direction of his gaze and spotted a girl of about the right age getting off of a bus. She started walking right away down the street, though she stayed on the other side, directly toward the L station, a block away.
"There we go," I said. "Kid walking a regular route alone gets jumped in Chicago. Kid's probably using public transit, running on a schedule. Makes her real predictable. Perfect mark for a predator." Will made a low growling sound. "I think I'm kind of smart, yeah," I said to him. "Get her scent." Will nudged me with his shoulder and growled again. I frowned and looked around until I spotted a rather large and rough-looking man descending from the bus at the last second before it left for the next stop. He started down the sidewalk in pursuit of the girl. He wasn't maniacally focused on her or anything, but he wasn't moving like someone coming home tired after a day of work either. I recognized his pace, his stance, his tension, just as Will had. He was a predator in covert pursuit of his prey. Worse, he had a smartphone. His thumbs were wrapping over it as he walked after the girl. "Damn," I said. "Whoever Black was, he was connected. I'm on the creep. You stick with the girl." Will gave me one brief, incredulous look. "I'm 6'9 and scarred. You're furry and cute. She's 11. She's gonna like you." Will gave me a flat look, his gold eyes utterly unamused. On a wolf, that's unsettling. "I don't know," I said. "Wag your tail and paw your nose or something. Go!" I'll give Will this much. He knows when actions matter more than questions. He took off at once, vanishing into the oncoming evening. Meanwhile, I put my guitar in the case, set it back into the alley, rose, and focused my will and attention on the thug. Wizards and modern technology don't get on well, and nothing dies as fast as cell phones when a wizard means to shut them down. I gathered up enough power to get the job done without taking out the lights on the whole block, flicked a finger at the man pacing the girl, and murmured, "Hexus." A wave of disruptive energy washed out across the street and over the man and his smartphone. There was a little flash of light and a shower of sparks from the phone, and the man flinched and dropped the device. Most people would have stared at it or looked wildly around. This guy did neither. He sank into a defensive crouch and started scanning his surroundings with wide eyes. He knew he was being threatened, which meant he had some kind of idea that a wizard might be about. That meant he was no mere thug. He was clued in enough to the supernatural world to know the players and how they might operate. That meant he was elite muscle, and there were only so many players who he might be working for. I checked the street, hurried through an opening in traffic, and went straight for him. He spotted me in under a second and ran without hesitation, both of which impressed me with his judgment, but he took off after the girl, which meant he wasn't giving up either. I swerved to pursue him, leapt, and pulled my knees up to my chin in the air, hitting the hood of a blue Buick with my hands as I flew over it and came down still running. We rounded a corner, and I understood what was happening. The thug I was pursuing wasn't the grabber. He was just riding drag, making sure the girl didn't bolt back the way she came. I saw the girl ahead being hurried into a doorway by three more men, and my guy poured it on when he saw them. I slowed down a little, taking stock. The goons ahead had seen me coming behind their buddy, and hands were going into coats. I flung myself into the doorway of an office supply store, now closed for the evening, and the thugs all hustled through their own door without producing guns on the street. Suited me. I had been hoping to get them somewhere out of the way anyhow. I waited until they were inside, gave them a five count, and then paced down the street. The door they'd gone through belonged to a small nightclub. A sign hanging on the door read, "Closed for remodeling." The door was locked. It was also made of glass. I smiled. I huffed and puffed and blew the door in with a pretty standard blast of telekinetic force. I tugged my sleeve up to reveal the shield bracelet I'd thrown together out of a strip of craft copper and carefully covered with the appropriate defensive runes and sigils.
I channeled some of my will down into the bracelet, and the runes hissed to life, spilling out green-gold energy and the occasional random spark. "All right, people," I called into the club as I stepped through the door. "You know who I am. I'm here for the girl. Let her go, or so help me God, I will bring this building down around your ears." I wouldn't, not while the girl was still in here, but they didn't know that. There was silence for a long moment. And then, music started playing from deeper inside the club. "Bad Romance" by Lady Gaga. "Okay," I muttered. "Have it your way." I advanced into the darkened club, my shield bracelet throwing out a faint haze of light from the runes, just enough to keep me from bumping into walls. I went through the entry hall, past a collection window where I supposed cover fees would be paid, to double doors that opened onto the bar and dance floor. I raised my left arm as if wielding an actual shield, the bracelet glowing, and stepped forward into the club. The little girl was sitting in a booth against the far wall. The four thugs were fanned out on either side of her, guns in hand but pointing at the floor. Sitting with the little girl in the booth was the ADA's pretty assistant. When I came through the door, she lifted a hand and clicked a remote, and Lady Gaga's voice cut off in the midst of wanting my bad romance.
"Far enough," the woman said. "It would be a shame if someone panicked and the situation devolved. Innocence could be hurt."
I stopped. "Who are you?" I asked.
"Tanya Wraith," she replied and gave me a rather dizzying smile.
House Wraith was the foremost house of the White Court of Vampires. They were seducers, energy drainers, and occasionally a giant pain in the ass.
"The White Court was headed up by Lara Wraith,
the uncrowned queen of vampires, and one of the more dangerous persons I'd ever met. She wielded enormous influence in Chicago, maybe as much as the head of the Chicago outfit, Gentleman Johnny Marcone, gangster lord of the mean streets. I made damn sure to keep track of the thugs and precisely what they were doing with their hands as I spoke. "You know who I am. You know what I can do. Let her go." She rolled her eyes and spun her finger through fine, straight black hair.
"Why should I?"
"Because you know what happened the last time some vampires abducted a little girl and I decided to take her back." Her smile faltered slightly, as it should have. When the blood-sucking Red Court had taken my daughter, I took her back and murdered every single one of them in the process. The entire species. I'm not a halfway kind of person.
"Lara likes you," Tanya said.
"So I'm going to give you a chance to walk out of here peacefully. This is a White Court matter."
I grunted.
"Black was one of yours?"
"Gregor Malvora," she confirmed. "He was Malvora scum, but he was our scum. Lara can't allow the mortal buck who did it to go unpunished. Appearances, you understand?"
"I understand that Gregor abducted a child. He did everything he could to frighten her and then fed on her fear. If Luther hadn't killed him, what would he have done to the little girl?"
"Oh, I shudder to think," Tanya replied. "But that is, after all, what they do."
"Not in my town," I said.
She lifted her eyebrows. "I believe Baron Marcone has a recognized claim on this city, or am I mistaken?"
"I've got enough of a claim to make me tickle to dump you and your brute squad into the deepest part of Lake Michigan if you don't give me back the girl."
"I think I'll keep her for a day or two, just until the trial is over. That will be best for everyone involved."
"You'll give her to me now."
"So that she can testify and exonerate Mr. Luther?" Tanya asked. "I think not. I have no desire to harm this child, Dresden, but if you try to take her from me, I will, reluctantly, be forced to kill her."
The girl's lower lip trembled, and tears started rolling down her face. She didn't sob,
She did it all in silence, as if desperate to draw no attention to herself. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't going to stand here and leave a little kid to a vampire's tender mercies.